I'm Kevin Clements, the director of the Toda Peace Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this public conversation between Dr. Mary Yi, Dr. Carol Fabotko, and myself. To introduce Mary, she has a PhD from the University of Queensland, which focused on in-depth studies of Indigenous communities in Fiji grappling with climate immobility or mobility. She's been deeply engaged in Fijian research on themes such as planned relocation, non-economic loss and damage, disaster risk reduction, and place belongingness. She's focused on developing culturally appropriate solutions for addressing climate change, displacement, loss and damage, and also gender inequality in the Pacific. She's an expert on community engagement and collaboration with a very diverse array of stakeholders, including government agencies, civil society organizations, faith-based organizations, youth groups, and affected communities. You've been working on climate change, culture, and human mobility and immobility for years now. Can you tell us how you first became interested in this topic and why?
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me today. For me, my interest in this area comes from a very personal place. 14 years ago, my mother passed away and was buried on our island. And like many burial sites in Fiji, ours is located by the coast. And not long after, we began to notice how quickly the ocean was changing and the waves becoming more aggressive and the storms intense. And, you know, it became more frequent, and it was heartbreaking to see that these powerful forces were encroaching those burial grounds. And, you know, in Fiji and in around the world, we often say when our loved ones, you know, they pass on, we often say they rest in peace as we farewell them. But for me, when I started to witness what this, you know, the nature was doing, what the wind and the rain and the waves was doing to our burial grounds where my mother was buried, it was very unsettling. So it wasn't just an environmental threat. It was also affecting our, you know, my connection to that. So this emotional experience is what made me determined to understand what was happening, and not only to the environment, but to also our way of life. So I began searching for opportunities to study further, and, you know, which led me to this PhD that I did and pursued at the University of Queensland. So the more I learned, the more I felt, you know, a responsibility and confidence to give back to Fiji to support communities in navigating these challenges, preserving our culture, our sacred burial grounds, and also to ensure that, you know, that decisions around mobility and immobility reflect who we are as Pacific people.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice to know, have that sort of personal connection and to know that this really flowed out of your concern about your mother and your family. Thank you.
So, Mary, you mentioned that you undertook your PhD at the University of Queensland as part of your interest in the ways in which climate change was impacting your family and Fijian culture more generally. Can you summarise the key findings of your PhD research?
Yes, sure. Thank you for that, Carol. You know, I was honoured that my PhD was awarded the most outstanding thesis at the University of Queensland for its contribution to policy and practice in the field of climate mobility. So basically, my research focused on the complexities of climate mobility and immobility in Fiji. And I examined deeply, in depth, three indigenous communities in Fiji. A community that was earmarked to relocate, but they choose to stay in place. A community that is currently relocating, And also, I looked at a community that has already relocated. Now, for one of the key findings, particularly from the community that was earmarked to relocate, but they chose to remain in place despite the high risk of high climate risk, was the critical importance of recognizing the cultural and spiritual dimensions of planned relocation. Their decision wasn't, simply about resisting the movement, but it was deeply rooted in their connection to ancestral place, to sacred sites, and a way of life. So this was one of the key findings from that community. The other one, the second community that I looked at, was a community that's currently relocating, in the process of relocating. So one of the key lessons or key findings from this case study was the critical understanding of engaging with the traditional existing governance structure and the understanding of local power dynamics when you're dealing with communities, especially in the Pacific region. So the importance of working with traditional leadership, not working against them, but working with them. And when you're working with existing structures, it gives that avenue or that entry point to making sure that you reach all the particular groups in the community, that no one is left behind. And when these communities see that you are working with their governance structure, they know that you care. And when they know that you care, they will be very open and forthcoming to also share with you, about their lives. So the last community that I researched on was the community. It focused on a community that has already relocated. This is also important to look at because there's always this question about when does planned relocation end? So a critical lesson from this community I found was that the realization that planned relocation does not end once the people are physically relocated. That's something we have to remember. Also, the implementers must remember that relocation does not only end when you relocate the community. Relocation is not a single event. It's a long-term process that requires constant monitoring and constant support from all stakeholders. Yeah, so thank you, Carol. That was some of the main key lessons that I found from my study, from my research.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mary. Your study was extremely rich, and it has been quite influential, I think, in papers that you have published from that research. It has been quite widely recognized, even globally, as extremely important research. And also, congratulations on your award-winning thesis. It's amazing work.
Yes, I used to teach at the University of Queensland, so I can underline that those awards for the best thesis are not given lightly. So congratulations. As a Fijian,
Thank you.
Mary, how does your identity and culture shape your work? I mean, what insights do you bring to the research that you're doing that you wouldn't be bringing if you were a kind of a Kiwi New Zealander or an Australian.
Yes, thank you, Kevin. I think as an Indigenous Fijian woman, an Indigenous Fijian person, my culture and my identity are at the heart of everything I do. Growing up in a community where, values like relationship, love, compassion, respect, even working together, they are deeply embedded. And I naturally carry these principles into my professional life. My understanding of all this research that I've carried out, engagement with the communities, working with policymakers and implementers. One thing I try and reflect is, the understanding of our culture and our tradition. It goes far beyond just land or relocation. Physical. It includes people, environment, relationship, spiritual connections, and this is what shapes how I approach challenges, and it ensures that the work that I do, it guides the work that I do is always people-centered, respectful of traditions, and also mindful of the environment also. Thank you.
All of those values that you mentioned are critically important at the moment in terms of the kind of world that we're living in, full of uncertainty, fear-based politics, unpredictability, and a real negation of compassion and relationship. So not only is it important for your work in Fiji, it's really important for the rest of the world.
Mary, you mentioned and have explained really clearly how important, culture is in shaping your work. Can you expand on the concept of Vanua, the Fijian Indigenous concept, and why it is important for Indigenous Fijian communities who are facing climate change impacts? Why is it important, I guess, for understanding what the appropriate solutions are and why it is so important for communities to be, I guess, heavily involved in driving those solutions.
Thank you, Carol. So the concept of Vanua, if one translates the word Vanua to English, a direct translation, it would mean land. But Vanua, in the Pacific context, in the Fijian context, it is a concept that goes beyond just meaning land. It is a holistic term that embodies this deep connection with the natural environment, the social bonds and kinship relationships that we have with each other. And this does not mean only a relationship with someone you're connected to through blood. It can be someone who's also close to you and you're connected to them, even not biologically. So it's that relationship also counts in this concept. Vanua also describes our ways of being, our ways of life, our spirituality, and also stewardship of place, how we take care of our environment. Now, for the Fijian communities, climate change is not just an environmental issue. It is a direct threat to that Vanua, that concept that I've just explained. It's a direct threat to the natural environment, relationship, to our ways of being, our spiritual life, and also environmental stewardship. So, as climate change threatens the physical environment, it also puts at risk the cultural, the spiritual and the social fabric of a Fijian life. So that's how climate change affects the Fijian community. It's not only about affecting the physical environment, but that entire concept of Vanua, which makes up all those dimensions that I've just explained. So the importance of recognizing and respecting Vanua is essential when we are adapting to climate change, relocation also, that includes relocation, ensuring that the solutions protect not only people's homes, not only the infrastructure, but the protection of heritage, the protection of our dignity, and also our ways of being. So that's basically the concept of Vanua and why it is important in the indigenous Fijian communities. So in terms of policy and practice, they must take into consideration this concept.
To what extent do you think that policy and programs in the Pacific are equipped to take the concept of Vanua and related concepts in other Pacific cultures into account to ensure that, in relocation instances, that the solution does not actually inflict cultural or spiritual harm?
Yes, we know while there has been a growing recognition of the complex challenges associated with climate-related relocation, I believe that most policies and programs that are in place, both in the Pacific and globally, they still are not fully equipping to prevent that cultural, spiritual harm for communities. Who are faced to relocate or to move. In the Pacific, the relocation is not just about, not just a logistical or infrastructural task. It deeply affects, our identity and our connection to that Vanua, that governance structure and that cultural continuity. And most many existing frameworks, they still remain state-centric and technocratic, and they're still focusing on the physical safety. They're still focusing on housing and infrastructure while overlooking that intangible losses, such as that disconnection from ancestral grounds, disruption of our traditional governance structures, our spiritual ties, and our community cohesion. So I still think there's still some space for growth. But while we acknowledge, like some countries like Fiji and the Solomon Islands, they have gone ahead and launched and their planned relocation guidelines, which has provided important strides and inspiration for other communities in the Pacific and beyond. However, there's still some room for improvement and efforts to address some of these challenges, especially during implementation of relocation, particularly when it comes to ensuring that self-determination and safeguarding of customary land rights, maintaining that social fabric. So I guess what I'm trying to say, in short, while awareness is growing, policy and program responses are still evolving. We're still learning, and this space is evolving at a very much, very fast rate. We're still learning, and we'll get there if we work together. Yes.
Thank you so much, Mary. And I think we can all see that the type of work you are doing is directly impacting this positive change. So, and we look forward to, I guess, seeing that, that uptake of a more cultural and spiritual and political even recognition that relocation programs need. So thank you for your great work in that area.
I mean, you've mapped out really well the kind of values
Thank you.
and strengths of an Indigenous approach to all of these issues. And I guess the question is, what challenges do non-Indigenous peoples in Fiji face in dealing with the climate change impacts? What do they rely on when they're making decisions about relocation and grappling with adaptation issues?
It's a really important question because I guess in most cases we focus always, not always, but most of our focus is on indigenous communities. We must realize that climate change affects everyone, indigenous and non-indigenous communities. They both equally face challenges. So in Fiji, I would say one of the challenges that these non-Indigenous communities would face, I would say it would be land tenure insecurity. So in the context of Fiji, majority, around 87% of our land is communally owned, customarily owned. So it's owned by indigenous Fijians, 87% under customary law. So for non-indigenous communities, for example, like our brothers and sisters of Indian Fijian descent, they often rely on lease land, for farming, housing, and businesses. The challenge here for them is when the climate impacts their communities, like flooding and coastal erosion, it damages this land, leased land, and these communities have limited rights. The options to relocate within secure land tenure systems, it could be expired or non-renewable leases could create, uncertainty in terms of relocation or resettlement. So I think that's one of the challenges they would face, is that land tenure insecurity. The other one I am thinking of is the limited access to traditional safety nets. In Fiji, Itauke communities, that refers to us, indigenous communities, we have a very strong kinship network, traditional governance structure, and communal support system embedded in that Vanua concept. The challenge for non-indigenous communities is they may lack these traditional or communal structures to rely on, especially in times of climate crisis. And it makes them more dependent on the government for support or assistance, or even on the NGOs, and which may not always, so this assistance from these NGOs or government, it may not always be timely or sufficient. And I guess by identifying these two challenges, I want to say that the Fiji Standard Operating Procedures for Planned Relocation that was launched in 2023, it clearly outlines and caters or accommodates non-Indigenous communities and also communities that live in informal settlements. So to make sure that when it comes to planned relocation, where they have to move, the operational guideline or the SOP, it provides a mechanism that helps these communities, non-Indigenous and informal, to navigate themselves in times of relocation. So land acquisition, how to get land, and transfer, and all those things in terms of planned relocation. So I think that's two challenges that I've identified, and also Fiji has tried to accommodate in the standard operation procedures guideline.
In that regard, I mean, do you think that this sort of fact that the non-Indigenous communities and the Indian and the informal settlements don't have the kind of resources to draw on that you do you think that's going to be a source of conflict in the future?
It will be, but at the moment, everyone in those who are in this space, especially the Ministry of Climate Change and Environment, non-governmental organization, faith-based organization, even the communities, we've been working together to try to address this. And I find now in Fiji, when it comes to workshops and conferences and just Talanoa sessions, I find that they are now including these particular groups. Non-Indigenous communities are always represented, and informal settlements, both in the rural and in the urban areas as well. So their voices are listened to.
So, Mary, given that you are very much at the forefront of, possibly globally in terms of what's happening with relocation. Can you speak to whether Pacific communities, I guess in particular, and maybe Fijian in particular again, do you think Pacific communities are starting to feel ownership over the relocation process, the processes that, started down as a top-down kind of initiative, but given a lot of the kind of complexities that people like yourself have been kind of bringing to this space to make it better, I guess, from a community perspective, to have their voices really heard. Do you think that some communities are starting to feel a bit more ownership over the process, or do you think there's more work to do?
Thank you for that question, Carol. In the Pacific communities, they are, I find that they are beginning to assert more ownership over relocation planning, but there is still work to do to ensure that the ownership is meaningful, the ownership is consistent, and also it's embedded in policy and practice. In many cases, I find that the communities now in Fiji, from my experience, they are not waiting for external interventions. They are initiating the conversations. They are identifying the risks. And even they are taking proactive actions, proactive steps to safeguard their future. In Fiji, we see examples of where communities, villages have requested relocation or implemented their own adaptive measures, reflecting a strong desire for self-determination. But however, systemic challenges like limited access to resources, technical support, there's not a really clear governance pathway. These are some of the challenges that often constrain how much control communities can truly exercise over relocation processes. I guess while the national policies in Fiji, like the Planned Relocation Guideline and the SOP, while they emphasize community participation, I feel the reality is that the power imbalances still exist between the state, the donors, and the local communities. And often relocation, I still find they are shaped by external timelines, funding conditions, even technical frameworks that do not fully align with the community's cultural rhythms and aspirations, even decision making and priorities. They're starting to feel ownership, but at the same time, there are some constraints that still exist.
Thank you. So, do you think some of the frameworks and guidelines, policies in place in places like Fiji, considering their kind of top-down overall approach, do you think that they have any kind of built-in flexibility for that to, for over time for work, coming from the communities to be able to change that to give them more power? Like, is that something that you see in those policies as being possible, or would it require a more sort of fundamental, redesign of those policies and programs?
For Fiji's policies, they have it in place, especially the integration of traditional leadership, the indigenous traditional leadership. It's something that they strongly have put in place, which is actually very good because the importance, in terms of Fiji's case, we're a very hierarchical and patriarchal community. We have that structure. So the importance of, they've put in that mechanism of the importance of the integration of traditional leadership, working with them, because it's this structure, these are the structure that's the backbone of helping our communities navigate themselves in this climate crisis. So I think with that in that policy, I think that's actually a very positive move by the Fiji government so far.
For communities that don't wish to move, Mary, I mean, what alternative solutions can they access, and are you working with those communities that want to remain in place?
So for these communities in Fiji that choose to remain in place despite climate risk facing climate risks, I think it's so important that implement the importance of respecting their decision and supporting them with adaptation solutions that uphold their safety, that uphold their livelihoods and cultural identity integrity. So whatever services is provided to the communities that relocate, the same services that's provided to the host communities, the same services that's provided to the communities who live close by the relocated site, those services should also be directed to those who stay in place. Relocation should always be a last resort. And for many Pacific communities, they prefer to stay in place because of their connection to place, their place-based connection. And I think some of the alternative solutions they can access is, number one, when they're staying in place, from an environmental lens, the introduction of nature-based solution in that place where they are currently staying. Number two, I would say the construction or the building of climate-resilient infrastructure, like seawalls and elevating homes, improving drainage systems. Another important thing that I always advocate for is working with them to learn about their traditional knowledge. Their knowledge is equally important, and their knowledge can contribute to extending the habitability of that place. So the importance of also learning about that knowledge, documenting it, and working with them on how to prolong their stay in that place. Another solution I would say to give to these people who choose to stay in place is giving them that option and that opportunity. Should they choose to relocate in the future, the government must give that space to them. In case they change their mind, they should be given that opportunity to move.
So, Mary, do you envisage a time when Pacific communities might welcome other communities onto their land when, people may need to move but don't have any of their own land, either left or in the first place to move to? And I'm sort of getting at here potentially the an un unrecognized role of Indigenous diplomacy, and that could either be within or even beyond existing national borders.
Thank you, Carol. Historically, Pacific Islanders have practiced forms of customary hosting, sharing land, resources, sharing resources during times of need, guided by cultural protocols and also chiefly systems. So yes, my answer to that question is yes, I do see that. And in some ways, I feel it's already happening. Where Pacific communities are grounded in their values of hospitality, kinship, and just collective responsibility and welcoming others onto their land when displacement becomes unavoidable. Some examples I want to shine light to is you've got Fiji land bought by Kiribati under the migration with dignity policy. So Kiribati bought a piece of land in Fiji. If and when their people will need to relocate, there's a piece of land already in Fiji, and Fiji is ready to welcome them. Another example I want to shine a light to is the land that was given to the descendants of Blackbirders from the Solomon Islands. They also have a piece of land and they are here in Fiji. So those are just some examples where you see that hospitality and that sharing of resources already happening between Pacific Island states. Pacific communities are, we're welcoming each other. But I, for me, while we have that spirit of generosity, I do think and I truly believe, I truly feel that it's important that these processes should be defined under the honor of, the importance, the sanctity of land and relationship. Indigenous diplomacy through chiefly relationships, kinship networks, they hold a very important role here to guide the processes and offer the pathway where, where people will move into other land and other areas. But when these processes take place, it is rooted in Pacific worldviews that Indigenous diplomacy should be acknowledged, should be embedded as the foundation of this process. And I guess for the challenge and the opportunity for donors and also for policymakers in this context is they must make sure that they recognize and they empower Indigenous mechanisms. So when this process takes place, they must make sure that this Indigenous diplomacy is acknowledged, that it is not sidelined. Make sure that it works together with a top-down approach. And if that is done, then yes, we will have a very beautiful Pacific Island society in the future.
Yeah. Oh, what a wonderful vision. And I agree with you. And I think almost that, the state will always have a place in these kind of, in Indigenous diplomacy, kind of instances where relationships are maintained or built regardless of what the state is doing, I guess. And in some ways, I feel like the state might be almost needing to take a bit of a back seat. So again, it's that issue of where the power is, isn't it? Are the states in the Pacific going to be willing and able to take a bit of a back seat and just, have that kind of, their kind of like basic framework in place for these Indigenous relations to be central and, really take the leadership rather than being just sort of acknowledged as part of what is essentially a state-driven process.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've already given us some wonderful examples of the way in which Fijians and Fijian culture and so forth have really been innovative in response to climate change and the necessity to adapt and evolve in relation to that. What lessons do you see emerging from the Pacific region for the rest of the world? I mean, one of the things which I think is really crucial here is that the rest of the world really needs to be more of in more of a listening mode to what you're doing and currently doing and are planning on doing than in a reactive and a didactic mode. So what lessons do you see have emerged from Fiji and the wider Pacific region for the rest of the world in relation to climate change and adaptation?
Thank you, Kevin, for that question. Yes, I think I believe that the Pacific Islands have demonstrated significant innovation in how they approach both climate mobility and immobility. Despite being some of the most climate vulnerable countries, Pacific nations have not positioned themselves solely as victims. They've shown leadership, they've shown creativity and resilience, and in shaping their responses that are grounded on in their cultural values and human rights and also long-term sustainability. And I guess one clear example of innovation in Fiji is the development of the Plan Relocation Guideline in 2018. And also in 2023, they developed their standard operating procedures, and also acknowledging Solomon Islands, who launched their plan relocation guideline in 2022, and now they are currently working on their SOP as well. So these are some clear examples of innovation. And these documents, these guidelines, they recognize that relocation is a last resort. They emphasize community participation, and also they integrate human rights framework, equity, equality, gender equity as well. And then you have some other examples, like countries like Kiribati and Tuvalu, which have also pioneered some unique approaches, such as the Kiribati concept of migration with dignity. That policy, it framed reframed mobility as not as a forced displacement, but as an empowered planned pathway for future generation. And I guess in summary, I would say that, while the Pacific faces immense, climate challenges, it has become a global leader, global inspiration in framing climate mobility and immobility through the lenses of justice, through the lenses of culture, and proactive governance. And I think the rest of the world can learn from the Pacific, holistic and people-centered and dignity-driven approaches, especially as more regions today will begin to grapple with that climate displacement and adaptation.
So, Mary, we're getting to the end of this wonderful conversation. What would you like to say as being, the thing you're most proud of in your work to date?
I think for me, the most important part of my work, which is something I'm always, is feeling the heartbeat of the people. I think for me, that means I'm as I talk about this work, it's not that I'm not standing for the community, I'm standing with them. I think that's one of the most important part of my work is contributing to centering community voices. That's always been my aim and my objective, that their voices should be the center of this this phenomena. And I've tried my best, and I'll continue to try to shift that narrative from viewing relocation as just a humanitarian response or a technical response, but recognizing it is beyond, it's a human, cultural, and political process. So I think for me, that's definitely the answer is centering community voices. That's been the best part of my work.
And so the final question really is, and you've already started foreshadowing that, is what do you see as the next steps in climate mobility policy and programs at local, national, regional, and global levels? And how do you make sure that your own work with communities and ensuring that community voices are heard it will play a part in those processes?
Thank you, Kevin. There's a lot of things that I'd like to see. I can think of two things at the moment. Number one is implementing or enhancing the community-led approaches. I think that's one of the next step that I'd like to see in this space, encouraging community-led approaches in planned relocation. I guess while many policies, mention participation and rights-based approaches, we need to move from just this rhetoric to practical mechanisms that put communities in the driver's seat. I think that's one of the things that I'd like to see, is that community-led approaches where they come in to design, to implement, to monitor, that we should always include them in the process. What does successful relocation looks like from their perspective? What is monitoring and evaluation from their perspective? That's always important. We must redefine some of these terms, and we need to look at it from their perspective. I think that's one of the next steps that I'd like to see moving forward. The other one is finance, sustainable finance, and accessible finance for our communities. And I'm very grateful. I just learned last week that the Fiji government has secured this global climate mobility funding, like a quick fund grant, where they are providing finance, direct finance to communities for climate change adaptation. So I'd like to see more of that in the future, where there's not a lot of red tapes and processes where communities have to go through in order to access that funding. So that's another thing that I'd like to see more of. And Fiji has secured that with the global funding, global climate change funding, climate mobility. And they're right now, there's a call for it in communities in Fiji. So those are, at the moment, those are two things that I'd like to see the next few steps: funding and also community-led relocation approaches.
Great, thanks a lot. Carol, do you have final comments?
Just to say thank you very much, Mary, for all your time and wisdom this morning. It was wonderful to speak with you.
Yes, and I just like
Thank you.
add to that that it's very clear that your own leadership flows from your strong commitment to and embeddedness in the Fijian Vanua. And I think I can see that you have developed a kind of a formidable presence based on that strong sense of culture and identity. So thank you for that, and long may your leadership prevail.